And welcome to the PyPodcats for our Hidden Figures of Python series. Today, our guest is Mona Obedoza. And if this is your first time you're listening to the PyPodcats, you're probably wondering what the PyPodcats are. We are highlighting the voices of underrepresented group members in the Python community. We have a code of conduct, which is the PSF, the Python Software Foundation code of conduct, and we follow it to help our interactions and keep Python a positive, successful, and growing community. And I am Teresa. I am based in Hamburg. And with us, we have our other co-host, Georgie, based
in... Hi, everyone. My name is Georgie, and I'm coming from... I'm based in Amsterdam. I'm coming from my mother's womb, but I'm based in the Netherlands.
So we are in a mood today because both Georgia and I are in, there's public holidays around here, both in Germany mm-hmm. and Netherlands. So it's a free day. It's sunny outside. We are not used mm-hmm. to this weather. So it gets to our head.
So, Mona, would you like to do a little quick introduction or about who you are?
Yes, absolutely. Hello, everyone. My name is Mona Obedoza. I'm a high school student from the Philippines, and I study at Stanford Online High School. I really love the code. I'm an aspiring artificial intelligence engineer. And because of that, my advocacy is also teaching other kids how to code. And to this end, I'm also a student ambassador for Women in AI. I'm the co-leader of the Girls Can Code Club at my school. And I'm the founder of the Purposeful Mochi, which is a little organization I started locally that holds workshops and hackathons to teach kids how to code.
That's very interesting, Mona, because I remember I saw you the first time when you attended one of the events in Python Philippines, and that triggered me like, whoa, this girl at this young age has started coding and knowing way more than what I know already. So I was totally impressed, to be honest.
Thank you.
I was like, one day I'm just going to approach and know a little bit more about this little Mona here. So how do you start learning how to code and doing all the programming?
I started learning how to code around the time I graduated from kinder. I was maybe around 5 years old. My mom was a software engineer at the time, and so she downloaded this app, and it was like the simple logic-based game where you instruct a dinosaur to move in a certain way and follow and like use that to complete certain puzzles, and it was meant to teach me like the basics of coding and logic and that kind of thing. And I was just absolutely obsessed with it. I just played it for a very long time. I think I finished it in like one night, and because of that, she let me move on to more advanced programming languages such as, well, I started with block-based coding languages like Tinker and then Scratch. And then because I couldn't get enough of that either, I eventually, in around third grade, moved on to text-based programming with Python, being my very first text-based programming language. After that, I started learning more things like HTML, CSS, JavaScript, some mobile app development with App Inventor. And recently, I started taking classes at my school also. And because of that, I also learned C++ and Java.
Holy moly.
So you know a lot of programming languages. Which one is your favorite?
I think Python is definitely the one that's closest to my heart. As I said, it's one of the very first ones that I ever tried. And I remember that when I was a kid, it was really my favorite programming language to do. I would always try to make different games with it. And I had this little Python book of games that I would always use. And even today, when I work on some projects, I always use Python for data science, artificial intelligence, because it just has so many libraries that are very well documented and make it very easy to get started with all of those things. And even when I teach kids how to code, I think Python is a really great language to get started with because it's not too complex. You don't need to remember brackets and that kind of thing. It just kind of like it's very simple and easy to pick up, and it's a really good way to bridge the gap between like block-based programming and early logic puzzles and later programming languages as well.
Wait a second, because I just wrote down here something because of your first game being with dinosaurs. Do you also have a special affinity towards dinosaurs?
Actually, I am very scared of dinosaurs. I refuse to watch dinosaur movies. It scares me a lot. But it's just that in that particular game, it was a very cute little chibi dinosaur, and so I just loved it a lot. But then in real life, dinosaurs scare me.
Yeah, I mean, It's just birds that are still around us, right? I mean, the other ones are all dead.
It's very disturbing.
And actually, Teresa is reviving them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm just putting them on paintings. It's fine. It's made up dinosaur, so it's fine.
Cute dinosaurs. I hope it stays that way.
Yes.
So just curious, like, why do you like Python more? Is it really because of like the language, or are you drawn to the community, or what's the reason why you actually prefer Python?
It's really a little bit of both. The language is honestly just so great. It's really a great way to get started with programming in general, get started with fundamentals before having to worry about complicated syntax and that kind of thing. And it also makes it really easy to get started with more complicated topics like data science, AI, and the like. But at the same time, I also really love the Python community. I think the Python community is really where I started my whole journey. I remember you mentioned that you saw me at an event several years ago here in Python Philippines, and that was probably that was my very first speaking engagement. I remember I just joined the Python Tech Conference because I love programming in Python. I wanted to learn more, and I found out that they were having lightning talks, and so I decided, you know what, why not? I might as well register, see where that takes me. And so that was my very first speaking engagement. And even though I was only around perhaps 10 years old or something like that at the time, they were all very supportive of me. I was so nervous to be speaking in front of such a big crowd for the very first time, but they were all so supportive and so engaged in my presentation, and they really made me feel welcomed and appreciated. And that's really what gave me the confidence to try other speaking opportunities, try signing up for summer camps, schools, and that kind of thing where I could learn how to code and improve my coding skills as well and get more involved with the tech community.
That's really cool. So you mentioned you got involved also in the Python community. What do you do in the Python community currently?
Generally, I still do some speaking engagements. I think I've been invited to a few speaking engagements in the past. Like, I've done a talk at the PyLadies Con, also at the most recent PyCon. And generally, I speak about my advocacy, which is teaching kids how to code. And I also speak about my organization, the Purposeful Mochi, which does exactly that. And I speak about some of the AI projects I do as well.
So tell us a little bit more about how you teach younger people to code, like the kids, or because it passed our level, you see. So we are in the adulthood. So you are still like in between, you know what I mean? So I'm really interested on like how you actually teach the kids code.
Right. Well, I started the Purposeful Mochi when I was pretty young, and it was just kind of like doing little coding workshops for my friends because we didn't really have coding lessons at my school at the time because we were very young. And so I decided it would be fun to just teach my friends how to code. And so we had little gatherings in coffee shops and that kind of thing. But eventually I decided to take that further. I started doing workshops with larger groups of people I didn't know and also younger age groups as well. And then most recently, I partnered with Accenture Philippines for the Breaking Barriers, Building Bridges Hackathon for Girls here in the Philippines, where basically girls of any level of experience with coding really can come join in like teams of around 3 or 4 and start learning how to solve problems using code. I think that hackathons are really my preferred way of teaching kids how to code because, well, first of all, it's very important, more important than just learning how to code. It's also important to learn how to use technology to solve problems. And that's exactly what hackathons are all about. You pick a problem, you make a project to try and solve it. And second, I also think that this increases their confidence a lot because when you join a hackathon and you make a project that can solve a real world problem, at the very end, you're able to take a step back and think, wow, I was able to create all of this stuff. I think it really improves their confidence a lot. And I think, that's generally what the Purposeful Mochi has been focusing its efforts on lately, doing hackathons and things like that, where kids can get started with coding and find out all of the amazing things that technology can do.
Right. Are you doing this all alone or do you have other people helping you out?
I have some people helping me out. So I have this one friend who helps me out with the Purposeful Mochi as well. And we just collaborate sometimes in teaching workshops and in reaching more kids. And aside from that, I also partner with tech companies such as Accenture, like I mentioned, and also with the Python community sometimes to seek more support.
You know, that's at another level because you are actually getting the companies involved at your age. Like, mm-hmm. How do you actually approach them?
Well, I think it all started really when I just had that first experience at the Python Tech Conference, and I started making connections, meeting new people, and then because of that, I started being invited to more and more things, and because of that, I ended up just meeting more and more people who I'm able to reach out to whenever I have an event. I get to reach out to them and ask, hey, do you want to be a guest speaker for this event and help inspire these kids and that sort of thing. So it's really just all about all of the tech conferences that I like going to and speaking at and making connections through there.
Interesting. to be honest, because I do have kids too. And a lot of young people, some of them, they feel like coding is not cool. So it's not easy to trigger them to pick up this, because it gives them a perception that it's actually hard, or like it seems to be like the learning curve is higher than other things. So how do you actually make it accessible or make it interesting to younger people to learn how to code?
I can absolutely relate to that. Most of the time when I was really young, and I was and a lot of the people I would talk to would think that coding was really hard, and that and coding and math and science, and especially girls, they would really think that it was really difficult. And that's why in my workshops, usually I get started with very simple things like block-based coding languages, starting with Scratch for desktop and game development, or Thunkable for mobile app development, to teach them that it's really not that scary at all. It's just doing some logic and putting some stuff together, and eventually you're going to end up with this project, and you're going to be able to be like, wow, how did I do all of this? It actually wasn't that tough after all. And I think there's a misconception that programming is all very technical stuff, algorithms, math, etc. It's like, wow, I don't want to have all of these formulas swimming around in my head. But in actuality, programming is all about, you know, logic, creative thinking, and that sort of thing. And that's why through hackathons and workshops and that kind of thing, where I get started with very simple programming languages and games and stuff to begin with, I hope to instill that impression that, you know, coding is actually something that can be fun.
Yeah, but I think that misconception came out also from like larger companies who had the whole phase of job interviews being algorithm cracking. So you have to know all the algorithms by heart and everything, and that was like the only way to get through the door. And I think that is something that there's a whole generation affected by that thinking, although they go in the job and then they don't apply any of the algorithms.
Very true. Yeah, but in reality, the real job does not really encompass what the interview go through. It's true. Yeah. It's true. I mean, yeah. For you, perhaps not a level yet, but I'm pretty sure you'll be hired by some big company soon. But I think that's a kind of like what Teresa has mentioned is a very interesting issue here, that in the tech industry, they tend to over test.
Yeah. Well, it's like, just testing on a different aspect that is then not really connected to the work.
And also, nowadays we have so many technologies and so many aids. You don't really need to learn exactly like
what and it's probably exactly how Mona is designing her courses. In the end, is like putting things together and getting something done.
Yep, absolutely. That's why I like doing hackathons, so that they can actually experience what it's actually like to program a project instead of just programming like a simple like some kind of mathematical thing. They actually program a project that has a practical use, and so you get to experience all the stuff where you're trying to come up with creative solutions, and you end up like spending a lot of time debugging, but also spending a lot of time designing things, ideating, brainstorming, and that sort of thing, and all of the things that make coding and technology fun.
Are your courses then also available online for like kids all over the world, or going to be available online?
Well, so far, I haven't done anything about releasing courses myself with the Purposeful Mochi, although we do some workshops, and they're mostly live workshops. But as far as coding courses go, I remember that when I was young, I did a few things on Khan Academy, I think, and also generally what helped me a lot was getting programming books. I had this book of like how to make several, like, I don't know, around 40 like simple Scratch games, and I would follow it, and I would make a lot of Scratch games. And then I had one also with Python, and it taught me how to make if conditions, for example, by making choose your own adventure games, or how to do for loops by doing alien invasion games, or that kind of thing. And that's really what got me interested in coding.
So games is the key.
Yeah, and not dinosaurs. I just didn't hear any dinosaurs. Sorry.
Okay, but I just realized there is one instance in which I like dinosaurs, which is like the Chrome dinosaur game. You know, the one where you keep on hitting space bars and there's no internet.
I see.
Google. Yeah. I understand that you started coding like really young. You mentioned once to me, like 5 years old?
Yeah, she
mentioned. Yes, I think around that.
So does looking young and being smaller help people interact with you? Do you feel intimidated sometimes if like people who try to like, you know, older people start to talk to you or things like that about the knowledge?
Or at you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, actually, there are really pros and cons to being small and cute, you know. When I go to tech conferences, well, Sometimes I feel really nervous, like when I'm about to go up in front, like, oh my gosh, all of these people have so much more experience than me. They're so much older than me. What could I possibly teach them? But that's why I guess I'm just so grateful that communities here are just super supportive, like the Python community, for example. They never looked down on me or anything like that. They've always supported me and invited me to speak at their tech conferences and help me out whenever I have a big event going on. And also, being young also makes it easier for me to talk to kids, I guess, like especially like when I teach workshops and when I hold hackathons. I guess it helps me relate to them more and come up with activities that they would find fun. And at the same time, it feels like being young kind of inspires them, you know, like if I can do all of these things, then so can they, I guess.
Yeah. Have you experienced being taught in the more traditional way coding? Did anybody try to teach you coding and is like, here's a programming book, let's go through it page by page, or let's write 20 programs and then you know how to code style?
I got most of my coding lessons at Stanford Online High School, where I currently study, and it's honestly, that's actually part of what made coding so fun for me too. The way that they approach teaching is really cool, and even when they do have to teach fundamental things like algorithms or the math behind it or like the hardware behind it, they do it in such a way where it's easy for me to understand what's going on by like drawing it out on the screen and showing it step by step. And it really just makes me realize that, you know, in the end, all of it is just about logic, and that's really the most important part, developing that logic and critical thinking skills. After you've done that, it's easy to pick up any language regardless of the syntax, and it's easy to understand the algorithms and all of that. So it's really all about building that strong foundation.
Right. Yeah. Have you actually like tried different educational books, and like some of them actually kind of like you couldn't get it, and like when it's exactly the same thing that you would like to learn, say for example maybe when you just started to learn like machine learning, like are there books that seems to speak to you more than others, or like apps or anything seems to work better than the others?
I think when I got started in machine learning, I used this website called Machine Learning for Kids. And the way it works is that it actually explained machine learning to me in a very easy way, because the way it works is that you come up with categories called buckets, and then you put in examples in each category. And then after that, you can deploy it to a Scratch game or a Python game or something like that. And so I just had so much fun with it when I was a kid. After school, I would sit down and I would go to that site all the time and try out all the different worksheets that they have and all the different programming projects that they have. And so, yeah, I think it was really those kinds of online resources that really spoke to me a lot when I was growing up. At the same time, receiving a formal education in programming was also really helpful for me, because I went online to learn all of the practical things about coding, but at the same time it was also really important for me to go to school and learn about all of the fundamentals going on behind it.
Maybe about that. So I mean, you seem to have like your education is like, it's not just home, you're not going, it's not very traditional in a sense, like you're going to school in a physical school, and probably the online aspect of it was triggered by COVID, or would that have been something that you would have planned before the pandemic to study on?
I actually go to an online school with students from all around the world. So I go to Stanford Online High School, and it's based in the US, but we have folks from just here in Asia. We have folks from Europe and different time zones and all of that. And so that's why all of us are online. And it was like that even before the pandemic, but I only applied here after the pandemic. And yeah, we really have a different way of learning stuff. And that's why I'm also able to learn coding at such a young age. But then over here, coding isn't part of the basic education curriculum yet. And that's why it's part of my advocacy to make it part of that curriculum and, expose kids to coding at a really young age and of the opportunities that they don't have.
Yeah, so cool. What do you do as part of your advocacy movement? Do you go like also in getting involved in politics with politicians, or because this is sorry, I mean, like
the
if you go to a
traditional,
like if you go to a normal school and you say, hey, I want you to do something, they're gonna be like, ah, you have to write I don't know how many forms, convince I don't know how many people, and all the children in the school have to sign, and all their parents and their grandparents. So I think that's kind of how it was when I wanted to change something in my school back then.
No, that's totally true though, and that's why I partner with tech companies to make things like a Breaking Barriers Building Bridges hackathon. I partner with Accenture, and that's why it's easier. It's easier to reach more schools and teach more kids how to code. Actually, I've done some things with the government before, like the DICT, the Department of Information and Communications Technology, once invited me to do a little talk on artificial intelligence for some of their students. So it's really heartwarming to see how they're implementing technology education already on some government level, I guess. But so it's not part of the curriculum, and that's why I do have some personal projects in order to make coding more accessible to kids and my own. And one of these projects actually is this thing that I've been doing lately called Mochiball, Basic Algorithm Learning Language. And basically, its goal is to bridge the digital divide and help public school students learn how to code. And the way it works is that instead of using a computer to write their code, each student is given a piece of paper where they can write down their program, basically. And then after that, the teacher will just scan it and upload it onto one computer and run it. And that way, students will be able to see it come to life on a digital screen. But at the same time, it's not the case that you need like 40 computers for one classroom. You actually only need one for the teacher, and all of the students will write it down on paper. So you get that whole thing where you get to see the code in action on your computer and get to think, wow, that's really cool, and also go through the debugging process. But at the same time, it doesn't require that much technical infrastructure, making it more accessible to public schools and rural communities.
That's very interesting, because that actually solved the problem of having like multiple laptops available in each classroom. So it kind of saved cost.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When I learned programming in school, we had programming class and we were learning Pascal on whiteboards, blackboards actually back then. But it was like you never knew what was going to happen, if it was working or not. So you only relied on the teacher. So yeah, and then I think that's cool with Mona's project.
Yes, I think that's really something that I wanted to emphasize a lot with Mochiball, because in traditional unplugged programming exercises where you write down stuff on paper, usually you're not able to see the output. But then when I taught Mochiball at a local public school, I think the moment when the magic happened for those kids was really when I uploaded the code onto the computer and they were able to watch it run, and they were all like, wow, that's so cool. And I think that's really one of the most important moments in programming, when you actually get something to work, when you actually see that hello world printed for the first time, or you see something moving on your screen for the first time, and it's like, wow, that's just so awesome, you know?
And it motivates people to like try it.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the developers spend a lot of time getting that to happen. So that's called debugging. And also, I hope that wouldn't demotivate a lot of young people, because it's just a daily part of life.
No, but like debugging is actually one of the fun parts, because even though it's super frustrating when you can't get it to work, it's always so relieving when you finally see, wow, this error was solved. Now it's a different error. That means I'm making progress. And then after that, exactly. when it finally actually works, you're just like, oh my gosh, I can sleep now.
That's so true. I guess it happens to every one of us. It's like sometimes it sounds just so easy, and then sometimes it just takes for hours and days, and you just couldn't figure out what went wrong. And then you just keep going back over and over and over again. The day you actually found out what happened, you was like, wait, what? It's like, then you go like, wait, why did I say that?
It's usually useful to sleep on it.
Yeah, recently my friend was working on his computer science project, and he was like, he was at it for like several hours, only to realize that the problem was that he used two equal signs instead of one equal sign.
Oh. Right. Sometimes two doesn't mean that it will be extra sure.
Yes.
So I was just interested because you mentioned about this project. And I also heard about your project, Teddy. So you seem to have a lot of projects going on.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So I would like to ask a little bit more about Project Teddy. But before that, can I ask, like, how many projects are you currently holding right now?
I think I do a different project every year, because I like joining tech competitions every year, and whenever there's like a prompt and I have to solve a problem for something, it always gets me thinking about how I can adjust it, and I end up having a new project every year. But I think the ones that are currently ongoing, and that I'm currently like, where I actually made it past the prototype stage in the recent years, and I'm working to take it further, are Teddy, the text-based early distress detector for youth, which uses artificial intelligence to assess whether a student might have a mental health concern, and Mochiball, the one I was just talking about a while ago, that's aimed to help bridge the digital divide and help public school students learn how to code.
I love this idea. Totally.
Yeah, so now tell us more about Teddy.
Yes, absolutely. So Teddy, it's short for the text-based early distress detector for youth, and the way that it works is that you upload an essay, schools will upload an essay written by a student, and then it's going to go through it line by line and use artificial intelligence to determine whether the student might be at risk for depression or self-destructive thoughts or that kind of thing, so that school counselors will be able to approach students accordingly. And so I guess And yeah, I guess the way that it works is that it's, you know, it's able to help connect students who are in need with counselors and help counselors figure out which students they should reach out to. And that way, hopefully, prevent mental health concerns from escalating.
How did you come up with the idea?
I know a couple of people in my community with mental health concerns. They who opened up to me about it, and I guess that really inspired me to try and connect them with the appropriate, you know, with the help that they need in order to get through that, I guess. And I guess the main problem with that is that when people have mental health concerns, it's always really challenging to try and reach out to the appropriate support. And so with Teddy, I hope to make it so that it's easier for counselors to figure out which students to reach out to and to help give them the support that they need.
So, but then students need to actively opt in for their data to be processed, right? To say, like, I want, in case there's something.
Yep, that absolutely. Yeah. And that's why we've been trying to work closely with schools in order to work on those privacy concerns and that sort of thing when deploying Teddy.
Right. I don't know much about the educational system in the Philippines, but do you have like a counselor in every school, or are they like set, like you have to go by for appointment or things like that for schools?
Yes, we do have counselors for every school. And the problem really is that for one counselor, there are like hundreds of students really who they have to worry about. And like if they have to read the reflection papers, for example, written by 500, by like several hundred students, they're probably going to miss a few who really need help. And that's what Teddy is for. It's to accelerate that process kind of, and using artificial intelligence and basically show which students are seem to be in most dire need of support. Of course, that's still up to the counselor's judgment in the end, because human judgment is, of course, really important in these kinds of situations, especially when actually talking to the student. That's where the counselors will really come in. But with Teddy, hopefully, it will make it a lot easier to identify which students need help.
Have you actually tested this pilot yet, or?
Yep, we have tested it at my school. We surveyed a bunch of people and had them write some essays, and then after that, what we did is that we ran them through Teddy and then put the results there, and then we also asked the counselors like to verify whether Teddy was accurate or not, and it was actually really accurate. Even some essays that looked like they were just about regular innocent topics like superheroes or that kind of thing, and it didn't look like there was any concern at all. Teddy was able to catch a concern, and the counselor confirmed that, so it proves that it's actually a very accurate technology.
Did you ever have the situation where a student is flagged at maybe having some struggles, but then the student denies having the struggles? Like, they do not want to be labeled like that? Is that also something happening?
I'm actually not sure. We haven't been able to take Teddy that far in my school yet, and that's why we've also been looking for more schools that we can partner with in order to get Teddy out there and try out these kinds of situations.
Have you ever thought of like expanding this project like worldwide to other schools around the world?
Yes, absolutely. The team that worked on Teddy are other students from my school. A lot of them are actually, the rest of them are from the US. And so they've also been trying it out in schools in the US and like schools that they're aware of in the US. And we'll see where it takes us.
So what's the hurdles that you have to jump for this project right now?
The main thing is finding a school that's willing to work with us, I guess, and that's why it's actually great that I'm able to bring up Teddy during this podcast, because hopefully if anyone is interested in reaching out and in trying to pilot Teddy in your school or in community or in our community, Teddy is available at teddytechnovation.streamlit.app, and so if you want to go check it out and then leave us a message if you'd be interested in piloting it and exploring it further.
Is there a specific age group like for Teddy, or any schools like universities, high schools, primary schools, everything is applicable?
Theoretically, we're hoping to expand it to everyone, not just schools, but also workplaces as well. But right now, we're mostly focusing on high school students because that's kind of data we collected and we're working with.
Maybe it would work out also for the Pilates community.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It could run as a Pilates workshop, and then everybody writes a short essay and then sees it in action. And then you're like, I don't know what the labels that are coming up. Surprise!
99%.
Everybody's depressed, you know.
Oh man.
Everybody's struggling. Everybody's getting a burnout. Yeah, tech world. So I think, interesting for grown-ups. It's going to be quite... different data set. Yeah.
I think that is actually a big issue related to mental health, especially for the tech industry workers, so which is developers and programmers included. So it's something that, unlike health, like physical health problems, it's really hard to identify.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Like with physical health problems, if you were stabbed or something and you're bleeding, everyone will be able to see it. But then with mm-hmm. mental health problems, even if you're, you know, even if it's reached a really crucial point already, it's really tough for other people to identify.
Mm-hmm. I'm loving Teddy. So
Thank
we should
you.
Have this tagline called I'm loving Teddy.
But I don't think it's just the tech community. I think it's everywhere. Mm, there's yeah. a lot of domains are facing changes way faster than before, and people are getting, you know, they feel unstable about their job and insecure about their job situation, and that affects them yeah. everything. So yeah.
I guess in our generation right now, it seems to be better than like 20 years ago, because it's almost unheard of, mental health. It's like
it didn't exist 20 years ago, right? No, everybody was healthy.
Yeah, everyone's healthy, and like, say, well, what's wrong? You just have to fight and get through this problem.
Men That's up, all. Men up,
yeah. yeah, men up, or like,
get over
you
it.
Are, yeah, get over it. Like,
get why yourself you together. Don't be so sensitive, Georgie. Yeah.
Another thing that I wanted to ask before that was that your learning journey. Because you did mention before that your mother is also a software engineer. So that does that actually help you, or does she actually like specifically gave you games that's related to coding, or you just self picked it up and like get more interested in programming, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, she helped me out a lot, really. She was the one who decided to teach me coding when I was really young, and she found this app and then she gave it to me, and she also supported me all throughout my journey. When I expressed interest in it, she gave me books and that kind of thing. She connected me with opportunities like hey, there's this competition here that you might want to try, or there's summer camp that you might want to apply to. And so all that aside, she's also really been my inspiration all throughout, I guess. And so and she's really my role model in life, honestly. She also taught me a few programming fundamentals. I remember, and also math and other STEM stuff when I was growing up. I remember we would usually sit down and then she would teach me some things. I remember she was showing me when I was really young how recursion worked and writing it down on a piece of paper so I could follow along. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. she was really, because of that, I really had the support to learn more about programming and technology. And that's really what inspired me to try and give that same kind of support to other kids who don't necessarily have that kind of background.
Does she encourage you to do other things, like other hobbies, or like let you go, let loose and just like try everything, Mona?
Yeah, she does encourage me. Well, she encourages me not to stress so much about schoolwork and extracurriculars and that kind of thing, and to play video games, read books, and do other, and you know, just have just also have fun with my life and that kind of thing. Programming is definitely very fun, but she also encourages me to let loose and de-stress a lot.
Do you have any hobbies other than, well, than programming and learning in school, which I guess for some people is not a hobby? But anyways, so.
Well, let's see. My hobbies. I like reading fantasy books. Lately, I've been getting into Brandon Sanderson's work and the Cosmere Universe and the Starlight Archive. I've been a really big fan of this lately. I'm also into watching anime, reading manga, and also listening to rock music and baking chocolate chip cookies for my family.
So maybe on our podcast, we can share also for the first time a recipe. Do you have a special recipe for the chocolate chip cookies? Is it like
yes,
a recipe? Oh my god! Okay, cool. That's.
I don't know how to describe yeah. it. I don't know how to describe it on audio, though. I think it's
no,
it's
no.
Just
you
in a book
you will send it to us. You will send it to
oh,
us.
Oh yes, I will send it to you guys.
Posted on the, our website.
We'll post it. Yes, exactly. It's gonna be the Mona Overdosa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
All right.
I truly believe that women should name things more often after themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. So there we go. But I'm just saying more women should do it.
Absolutely.
So Georgie should also use for example on Twitter, I think Georgie is really famous for espresso with orange juice.
Oh wow.
And that should yes, if you go on her Twitter, you will see that she's posting different pictures of that.
I just posted one today.
Exactly.
So I tried to imagine what espresso with orange juice tastes like.
There you go. There you go.
Well, it's actually really easy. Yes. Very easy. So you need fresh orange juice. So you have a glass of fresh orange juice, and then you just order a double espresso, and you just pour on top over it slowly, and then you'll get this double layer, like the top layer of the espresso and the bottom layer orange juice. So when you use a straw to drink, you actually pops down. It has a combo of espresso and orange juice.
Wow.
It's the best for the morning because you want to be awake and you want to be alive. So that's my secret.
And I heard that you're not allowed to drink coffee yet.
Yes, I'm not allowed to drink coffee yet. Unfortunately, if I were, I would try this instantly.
But you can have decaf espresso.
Oh yes. Okay, I will try decaf espresso orange juice. It's the next thing on my drink agenda.
Yeah,
and I think that the secret to having this layered effect, because it's not really pouring slowly, might still not cut it because it's also temperature-wise, they have to be, is to pour with a spoon. Like you have a teaspoon and then you pour it in the spoon and that breaks down the gravity and stuff. So there goes.
Wow.
I usually prefer those orange juice that has like a freshly squeezed. Mm, yeah. So you have the sap. Mm. So with the sap, that's weight. So when you pour over, it will just lays down.
So
easy.
There you go. Yeah. So Mona, what are some of your goals in the future? It feels like you have a lot of intention in your life compared to, at least if I remember when I was your age. I don't remember what I wanted back then, but it feels like you really know what you want. So where are you going next? What are you going to do?
Well, right now I'm in 10th grade. In a couple of years, I hope to go to university abroad. I'm aiming for to get into Stanford or MIT or that a school abroad and learn more about programming and technology so that I can go back here and then teach more kids how to code and all the things and share all the things that I've learned, I guess. And I guess another goal of mine is to pilot Mochi Ball in more schools. So I'm currently working with a tech company to pilot it with some schools locally, but we're just getting started. And I hope and I also have to mention it here and to mention that if anyone wants to try it out in your own school or community, you can also reach out to me because we're really trying to spread Mochi Ball and that's pilot it this year. So that's another more immediate goal of mine to use Mochi Ball to get programming and technology integrated in the basic education curriculum by making it more accessible to kids and also more fun.
Right. So our podcast is listened to by a huge Python community. So if you, other than this project that you mentioned, if you have any other help that you need, I'm pretty sure they will help out. Just tell us.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I guess there is just one more thing aside from Mochi Ball and Teddy. As I mentioned, I partner with Accenture to hold the Breaking Barriers, Building Bridges hackathon for girls and to teach more girls how to code and how to work on their own projects to use technology to solve problems. And and if anyone knows a school in the Philippines or even abroad, we can try to extend it abroad too. That would be really fun. If anyone knows a school who might be interested in sending a team to join this hackathon, then do let me know as well. And that would be really awesome.
When is the hackathon?
It's held every February to March every year.
Okay. So it's for next year now.
Yep. Cool. It'll be for next year.
So there's plenty of time for people to plan.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe you two can even be guest speakers at the next hackathon. I think you guys would be really inspirational.
Oh, we can even get all the PiPod Cats host.
Yeah.
All four, the combo. Mega combo.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Thank you so much, Mona. I see that we come to the end of this podcast. So is there anything else that you would like to address to our listeners here before we end this podcast?
There's nothing I can think of right now, so I just wanted to say is thank you so much. It's really been such an honor to be here, and it's been super fun talking to you guys. And so thank you for the invitation.
Thank you
for joining us. And we hope to see you soon somewhere around the community. I'm sure it will be real soon.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. Thank you so much.